Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Men behaving badly. There was a time back in the 1990s and early 2000s when that phrase brought a smile to the faces of many fans who enjoyed the, by those days' standards, fairly innocent antics of two somewhat sexist, responsibility-shirking boy men in the long-running UK and later US remake of the popular TV sitcom of that title. But with recent revelations of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, domestic violence, and misogyny running rampant throughout society, government, the workplace, and indeed every facet of life, the subject of men behaving badly is no longer a laughing matter. Joining me tonight is psychotherapist, sexologist, author, and speaker Thomas Haller, whose latest book, Dissolving Toxic Masculinity, explains how prevailing societal standards, many of which are so ingrained we rarely even think to question them, are having an insidious influence on the development of our sons and increasing the potential for their growing up to be chauvinistic, misogynistic, bigoted men who believe that aggression and dominance over women is normal masculine behaviour. The author of 9 highly acclaimed books, Thomas Haller is a certified sex therapist, sports counsellor and forensic social worker who's maintained a 30-year private practice working with children, adolescents and couples. He's also spent the last 15 years working in radio and TV, answering viewers' parenting and relationship questions live on air. Thomas Haller, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thomas, it's been a year now since the eruption of the Me Too movement, and still voices throughout the country and indeed the world are vociferously demanding change. Some argue that sexual harassment, chauvinism have always been a fact of life and will never totally eradicate it. Others claim it's women's fault, not men's, so we need to change our attitudes and behaviour. In Dissolving Toxic Masculinity, you say that we heed this call for change by raising our boys to be emotionally healthy, masculine men, which is a process that begins at home, because change happens when parents embody and model what they want to see in their children. I heartily agree, I'm sure many others do too, but how do you get people to recognise that what they're currently embodying and modelling is perpetuating the problem when their own deeply embedded attitudes and behaviours have been shaped by their childhood conditioning?
We have to step back a little bit and look. Just because this is the way it's always been doesn't mean we have to continue being that way. And we look at where we've come up to this point. If we just keep going, keep coming back to this point. So what we do then is bring up and show, here's some of the attitudes, here are some of the statements that people have made that have gotten us to this point. And now let's not make you wrong for being in that same spot because you grew up in it, but let's present you with other options so that you can grow from what you grew up in. So you know, masculinity isn't toxic, not in and of itself, right? It's how society has defined it. It's the parameters that it's put around it, and what it really means to be masculine. And that's what we can talk about, how that men can be masculine in a lot more ways than just demanding obedience or being powerful or promoting aggression and rage. We can have men that are masculine and and gentle and kind and empathetic and compassionate.
I totally agree with you. But, you know, your book is a real eye-opener. Until I read it, you know, I didn't realize how much of the way we speak, the things that we say, the way we interact with each other has such an incredible impact on the children around us. And I've spoken to many women over the last week or so, 2 weeks since I've been reading your book, and I've talked about some of the things that you raise, some of the things that we don't even think to question, and they've all agreed with me. And then they've gone home and they've continued to act in just the same way because they don't even know that they're doing it.
Yeah, so one of the first steps we have to help is where you started, is they have to become aware. We all have to become aware of our behavior and make changes from there. So the awareness becomes the first step. So we work towards becoming conscious and staying conscious and listening to ourselves as we talk. And whoa, there's one of those things I read in the book. And then back up and rephrase it and start over. And so you get conscious, and then you start practicing skills to stay conscious, and you begin to live the message, and then you share the message and go through the lessons in dissolving toxic masculinity that can help your sons grow. So you're going to grow, a lot of parents will grow right with their sons through this.
I'm sure they will. I mean, you've spent 30 years more counseling couples, adolescents, teens. What have you noticed over that period of 30 years? I mean, has our attitude changed a great deal? Because, you know, the TV program that I referred to earlier, back in those days, in the 1990s, we laughed at some of the sexist behavior. You know, we just, you know, oh, that's just men. Nowadays, we're really offended by it.
I'm glad that we've started to move in that direction, to see that as not how we want to be in this world, and to be able to look back and say that's the way it used to be. Well, I would hope have continued to evolve and mature as a society, as a people. We expect that from our medical field. And we expect that from the technological field. We don't look back there and keep wanting that which was, and we recognize that which was can be different and can be better. Well, we can do the same thing with our attitudes and our approach towards how we treat women in the world and how men treat women, how women treat other women. Those are all important aspects of where we start so that we can teach our children how to grow up differently.
You know, we're dealing with millennia, you know, many thousands of years of conditioning here, and the attitudes, you know, they run so deep. And yet, you know, there were times when we had, you know, much more equitable kinds of societies. I think that in, you know, indigenous cultures where there were rituals and there were ways, you know, rites of passage that men went through to understand that they'd crossed a threshold from boyhood into manhood. And they were much esteemed. And in some of those indigenous cultures, women were equal. There weren't these problems. Do you think that the fact that we've lost so many of our rites of passage have contributed to this problem?
Right. Does happen to be one of the sections that I do cover in dissolving toxic masculinity, and that's where we want our boys to grow up with moving beyond just having tolerance and moving into being able to have a compassion, but being able to have acceptance of other cultures. And how do we help them get there? One of the ways that I talk about is maintaining some of the rituals that have been such an important part of a culture. And so that was something that certainly I stressed in the family. I have two boys of my own, and that we worked at developing rituals that we wanted to keep as a family that we were, but we brought in some from the past and talked about how we can continue to create a history for our family and an identity and a purpose for our family. And then we started looking at other rituals and other families so that we could appreciate and celebrate the ritual that they bring to our society, to just our neighborhood even, and begin to practice some of those that we found endearing that fit for our family as well.
Before we start talking about how we can transform this situation, tell me a little bit about where this all began for you. I mean, did you have a childhood in which you were raised to respect women? Were you taught by your parents the things that you are now passing on to your children and others?
I have a really interesting story around that. When I was really young, my sister and I still laugh about this. It was my mom was, I have an older sister and a younger brother. And so my mom was pregnant with the younger brother, and my dad made the claim that if this child is a boy, we're going to get a dishwasher. And we'll go out and shop at the Sears and Roebuck, and we'll go buy a nice, you know, dishwasher. And if this child is a girl, then we already have our dishwasher, and she will fill that spot. And so, I kind of grew up in some of that toxicity, because we didn't realize it back then that that's what it was. And I went through a process of growing up in some of that, and growing through a change that my dad went through from there. That I grew with him, and I have some experiences that I write about in Dissolving Toxic Masculinity, where he taught me about how to appreciate culture and where people come from in their points of views and their culture, and then that got extended later in life to how we treat women. So it was kind of like I had a little bit of that evolution in my own family with my own father that I continued on with my boys, and have two boys that are very passionate about being who they are, not for somebody else, but for themselves, and embracing that same notion in other people, men or women or of any race and gender. So I stood there on in the middle of the debates for the election over a year ago, and I said to my wife, uh-oh, we're in trouble. And it wasn't because I had this idea that I knew what the outcome was going to be. It was how things were already being handled by the men that were there on stage doing the debates. And I sat down and started writing. And that's where I started saying, we need lessons that the family can use to move from here.
Well, you obviously have raised your children very successfully using these strategies, these tools, these philosophies. I mean, your son, Reese, is... well, he's finishing his senior year, and he's been majoring in feminism, and he's heading off to graduate school to pursue a doctoral degree in feminist epistemology.
Right. He's there now. He is actually in a program now. He just started in September. Yeah. So when I was writing, the book came out in April, and he was just finishing up, and now he's there.
And it would have been interesting to have him on tonight.
Yeah. Yes. He's knee deep in his studies, I'm sure. So, he is very passionate about being a part of the feminist movement, to the point that he wants to continue on and be not just an activist but also a teacher, and he wants to get a position as a professor teaching in the field and writing in the field of feminism.
Wow, that's really interesting. You know, I think what the Me Too movement has done is it has raised so much awareness, especially among men, of the things that perhaps they never even considered could be construed as sexism or harassment. You know, just the other morning I was watching a program on television in England, where I am at the moment, and it was about young girls, as young as 12 years old, who are receiving catcalls as they're walking to school in their school uniforms from men passing by in vans. There was a time when I was a girl when catcalls, you know, we preened because we thought it was a compliment. Now we understand that it isn't a compliment at all. In fact, it's an invasion of our privacy.
Yes, it fits into what one of the sections I bring up, the very catcall, and it's part of, you know, rape culture. And what is rape culture and what does rape culture look like? And I cover that extensively in Dissolving Toxic Masculinity, because the boys need to know. We have to bring them up with the notion of what they're saying, how they're acting, is an approach to women that is invading them. And, yes. And we need not go down that as a masculine men. We can be masculine and not go there.
Well, I want to get into this. Tell us more about rape culture, what it is. I want to talk about consent as well after the break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. My guest today is psychotherapist, sexologist, author, and speaker Thomas Haller. And we're talking about his book, Dissolving Toxic Masculinity, which offers 9 lessons for raising boys to become empathetic, compassionate men. We'll be back with more after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Hi, this is New Age Grammy winner Paul Avgerinos. Thanks for listening to OM Times Radio, and please support my peaceful healing music with a purchase at iTunes, Amazon, or wherever you shop for fine music. Just put my name into the search engine, Paul Avgerinos, A, V like Victor, G like George, E-R-I-N-O-S. You can also visit me at roundskymusic.com. Thanks for listening, and I'm wishing you the brightest of blessings.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Thomas Haller, the question of consent has become a really hot topic of late. And I think it is one of those, you know, areas that confuses boys very much indeed. Talk a little bit about consent and what you write about that in the book.
I just did a presentation for educators on consent and how to teach that in the classroom. And so it's an extremely important piece that we have to remember that we keep coming back to, because we have to be able to have our boys know what consent is and what it isn't. So to keep it clean and crisp, all right, consent is a verbal agreement. And it's a verbal agreement to participate in an activity with another person. It doesn't have to mean that that's a sexual activity. It certainly could, but it could be in any activity that we have to make a verbal agreement about what that is. And consent needs to be clear and concise. And somebody who's giving consent, they can't feel as – they have to be able to feel as if they can say no at any time. They can't feel pressured or forced into giving consent. It just has to be given freely, and the other person has to accept the answer, whether it's yes or no, or whatever that consent might be or might not be. And so consent is not ever based on how one looks or how they might be dressed. It's always a one-time event. So I can give consent for this moment in this time to do this thing with you. Doesn't mean I'm giving you permission to do that with me again and again and again and again any other time. So if we take it out of the idea of, for a moment, not talking about it with sex or sexuality or sexual acts, but just put it in any other act. So my wife is a triathlete, and she'll train and she'll ask me to go running with her, and sometimes she'll like, oh, let's go run 5 miles. And so if I agree to do that, I give her consent to do that today, that doesn't mean every time she wants to go run 5 miles that I have to go too. I get to say, nah, today I prefer you do this one without me. And everybody goes, well, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's the same thing with anything else when we interact with somebody else. And so then when I do assemblies at high schools, and I talk about this with when you're wanting to sit down next to somebody at the lunch table, just ask them, hey, do you mind if I sit here? That's asking for consent. It's seeking consent. If you want to walk with you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and you want to go for a little walk, and there you are in the park, and you're thinking, I want to hold her hand. Well, just ask, hey, do you mind if I hold your hand while we're walking? And everybody, oh, that's weird. It doesn't, but that's the point of consent, is that it can't just be something assumed, and we don't want to bring it up because it might make us a little uncomfortable. Well, if it makes you a little uncomfortable to bring it up, maybe you shouldn't be doing it. So if you can bring it up and ask and then go the next steps.
But many young girls will say that they feel pressure without even being pressured. A boy may not be pressuring them at all. He may be, acting as though he wants more. And out of politeness, or, for many, many reasons, being afraid to say no to somebody or really wanting the boy to like them, they say, well, they don't even say anything. They just, surrender. And then it's only afterwards that they then realize that actually that's not what they wanted. And there may or may not be a consequence, a problem. We read so much about girls saying, well, actually, I never wanted that. She didn't exactly say no. She didn't get the chance, perhaps, to give a verbal yes, but she didn't say no. And so it was taken for granted. I mean, how is a young man going to know what to do in situations like that? In the heat of passion, it's often hard for them to be that observant, to know that the girl really means no.
Well, so then I have the young people that I work with in my office, the teenagers, is that I teach them how to question themselves, so that they can take a moment and ask a series of different questions, and we practice doing that to create ways to contemplate and do self-questioning. So do I feel comfortable? Do I feel pressured? How do I want to feel here? Could I get hurt by this? Is this action that I'm about to take the person I want to be? They can do that, and teenagers actually do go through a process. And a lot of parents think that they don't pay attention to consequences and outcomes, and it's not true. They do. They just oftentimes set it up based on a different criteria than what most adults do, and so we get them to, if they can set a criteria, we help them adjust that by adding in some of those type of questions that they begin to contemplate and question themselves, and they can do it. We think that they can't, the hormones are going to take over, but that's what they have to understand about themselves. My hormones aren't in charge of me. I can still make rational decisions. And so then one of the questions is, does my rational mind agree with my hormones? And we want them to look at that. And they can, and they do. When we teach them how, and we go over it, and we have them practice it, and we keep stay in conversations about what's going on in their life. It's kind of a little bit of a myth that a lot of parents have, is that if we talk about sex or any of the things we don't want our kids involved in doing, then that's going to want them to do it more. And it's really not the case. The more that you can talk about and create open dialogue, the more they can bring understanding to it and incorporate that into their being.
In Dissolving Toxic Masculinity, you say that for a boy to become a man who honors and respects consent, he must learn to become an autonomous person. And that boys who grow up in controlling environments where their autonomy isn't respected have difficulty both seeking consent and giving it, but they can learn how to be autonomous. And you offer a three-step process, which I'd like you to tell us a little bit about. But before you do that, I want to make the point that, you know, there's two things going on here. You're quite right in what you're saying, is that we've got to model and embody the behavior that we want to see in our children. And if we do that from the earliest times, then we're going to be far more successful. What about somebody who's already got teens, who hasn't been modeling and embodying these things, and read your book, and now suddenly they want to change? How easy is it to begin to change a pattern that's already been long set? You know, how do you suddenly start, as you say, you know, making a boy, a teenager, who's not had good modeling, learn to be autonomous?
So that it might begin with having frank conversations. This is where I was, and I'm noticing that this is where I'm at. This is not where I want to be, and so we're going to move in a different direction. And so I'm going to help you move in a different direction. You're going to help me move in a different direction. We'll sort of grow together through this. We'll talk about it and come up with a way to help each other through the process.
So tell us then about your three-step process that does help them learn to be autonomous.
Yeah, the part of being autonomous is that they have to be able to understand consent. They have to know how to give consent for other things as well as receive consent. And so the three-step process is first through verbal responsibility, is that the goal is really about encouraging boys to create their own voice and to be able to be independent and self-responsible individual, and to use self-responsible language. And a key piece in that self-responsible language that I talk about in Dissolving Toxic Masculinity is to be more aware of their makes me language. So what that they're not placing the power in someone else or in the event or in the environment around them, that it makes them something. It turns them into something. So a phrase like, well, she turns me on. No, she doesn't turn me on. You might choose to be turned on by her looks, but that's a choice you make. And so we teach that self-responsible language, that first you have to be responsible for how you talk about the world in which you live, because that affects how you view the world in which you live. So that becomes an important key piece. And so there's a whole chapter just on responsible language and how to teach that. And then the next step – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please continue.
That was step one. Oh, okay. All right. So step two is then we teach about opportunities. And having life experiences they're really important for children's development, and the opportunity it always comes with a responsibility. So there's opportunity equals responsibility, and so we use what I call a dynamic discipline equation to help them create an understanding of the cause and effect connection between the opportunities I have and the responsibility I have with them. And if I choose to be to remain responsible with this opportunity, then I've decided to continue to have the opportunity. If I choose to not be responsible with the opportunity, then I've decided to not have access or not continue that opportunity. So then who's in charge of them having more opportunities and doing more things? They are. And they see themselves as the cause. And now this isn't something that someone else is thrusting upon me. That's something that I'm learning to handle for myself and controlling and handling within me. So I am now the cause of what shows up in my life. It's not based on other events or circumstances out of my range of choices. And then I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
Okay, well, then the last step is how to teach about choices and teaching them to make appropriate choices. And we start early and as often as possible with using words like choose, pick, decide. When you choose this, you've decided that. When you pick this, you've chosen that. So that they can see, I am making choices about stuff. I can handle my behavior. I can handle my, like we were saying earlier, I can handle my hormones. Those things I can do. And I have choice, and I can exercise that choice.
One of the lessons that you teach is suspended judgment. What does that mean?
Well, before we are going to call somebody a name or label them in some way, is to step back and suspend that. Don't judge them for who you think they are, what you think they represent, what you think they might know, or what you think their cultural background says about them. And you hold that, you suspend that, so that you can lean in and learn more about them or their culture or their experiences, so that the judgment is set aside, just as much as you wouldn't want to be judged wrongly. We want you to be able to see other people for who they are over time, not just in that snapshot moment that you're making it. So then we help them begin to be more descriptive with their words rather than judgmental with their words, rather than labeling. Judgments like labeling somebody. So I look through their language patterns, and we talk about, just even, math is stupid. Well, okay, that could be restated by saying, a math we're learning right now is difficult for me to understand. We're reframing that judgment on that. This car is a piece of junk. And they can rephrase that. They be descriptive about it. There's rust all over, the fenders are falling off, or there's no tread on the tires. You can say descriptive words about things. You can describe things about people rather than calling them names. She's lazy can be rephrased as she waited until the last minute to do this homework and be a part and do her part in our group. Or he's a slow learner. It could be in something that can become, it took them, a week to understand these divided fractions. And you teach that to them, that when you're looking at people, be more descriptive in how you talk about them rather than going to labeling them, because the label becomes a judgment that's based on limited information.
Of course, parents love labeling their children. You know, my child is smart, my child is pretty, my child is this, my child is that. They sound very positive. You know, why would we need to stop using, descriptions like that?
Oh, we're coming up against that, what we call I ams. Oh, these are the children, by the time they get to kindergarten, they're 5 years old, right in that range, they come with a lot of I am these kinds of things, right? And we say, well, if they're negative things, that's not good. If they're positive things, well, that is good. And I would say, well, then in that, if you're labeling them that way, you're also containing them to those things now. And there will be less future change and growth that they will take and stretch themselves outside of that. As it becomes one problem. If I'm labeled as being really, a math whiz, then I lean that way more often than I may not stretch myself in the areas of reading or in history. And so you can enjoy math. And you're handling math well, and these are other subjects that you know how to handle too. And we just take the label off. The other is when we label kids in this, you're an athlete. It sort of sets them up to only think of themselves that way. We want them to think of themselves as that plus much more, and there's much more coming. And so
you're listening to
stay
What Is Going
labels
On.
Altogether.
I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with psychotherapist, sexologist, and author Thomas Haller about his latest book, Dissolving Toxic Masculinity. We'll be back after the break.
Cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. Om Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single Om Times endeavor. Host your show with Om Times Radio Network.
My name is Victor Furman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Hi, this is recording artist and composer Yuval Ron, inviting you to a voyage through the chakras, a new double album of guided meditations to transform your life, a sublime musical medicine for nourishing inner peace and reaching to your higher virtues. Get it now at metamindfulnessmusic.com. M-E-T-T-A mindfulnessmusic.com.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Thomas Haller, in your book, you say that a large contributor to toxic masculinity is that boys are being raised in homes with empathy deficit. Tell us what you mean by that.
I see a lot of children that really don't understand their feelings, and they don't know how to talk about them or describe them, or they don't even know what it is they're having. And it starts to narrow down into like just one feeling is this. So I see empathy deficit as this chronic condition that gets brought on by adults' refusal to have boys have an array of feelings and teach them about all the facets and rich ways that your body feels, and it just kind of gets pushed down into being strong and face adversity and be aggressive, and really the only feeling that is important here is that which is filled with anger, because there's where the power lies. And so there's this deficit in the other areas of feelings when it comes to raising boys. We're not expressing sadness or fear or hurt or weakness or God, how to be soft. And those things are seen as being too feminine. Boys can't cry, or they can't be scared, they can't express pain, and so we end up hearing the boys end up hearing a lot of that stop that crying, or it's not that big of a deal, or why don't you just suck it up, man up and get back out there, are kinds of things that they're growing up with hearing, rather than letting themselves know that it's okay. It's okay to have a full range of feelings, and here's how you express them, and here's how we can talk about them, and here's what you can do with the other feelings.
So, what else could we do to teach boys empathy and compassion?
So in empathy and compassion, we have to think about the way that behavior management takes place and how we help them seek solutions and how to problem solve. And so the way that we address their behavior and what's happening for them can affect how they understand their own emotions. So one of the things that parents can do with helping to learn with beginning that piece of empathy and aggression is empathy and compassion is how we handle their aggressive moments, or maybe their tantrum moments when they get into a tantrum mode. How we approach those is the beginning steps in demonstrating empathy and compassion for someone. You're there at, acting, hitting, kicking, biting, punching, scratching, throwing things. You're stomping your feet, or you're screaming out loud, "I hate you!" And parents want to move in with power and with force and with ways to try to stop that, rather than first you move in with empathy and you move in and say, "Why, you seem really frustrated right now that you could use those kinds of words, and you're stomping your feet, and you really wanted to do it this way, and now it's not working out for you the way you wanted to. Let me see if I can." If you start like that, you've positioned yourself on the side with the emotion that's happening. And they learn that their emotional state is honored. And then you move to how can we behave differently so you can still get what you want in a more peaceful way, so we're not disrupting our environment as much.
You know, your nine lessons, they cover some really important topics like teaching cooperation, not competition. Don't allow teasing because, you know, we think it might be fun and we think that people have to man up and learn to accept a bit of teasing. But actually, we're giving some poor messages there, teaching beyond tolerance, etc. What do you think is the most important of these nine steps?
I think that the most important of all of the steps together, if we wrap all the knowledge, all the best lessons we could teach and the information that we could impart or the wisdom that we could pass on from the ages, that doesn't add up as much as how it is that we as adults and live our lives, that we are the model of the message, so that they can not only hear the lessons, but they can see how that plays out in somebody's life. They can see how their father interacts when he's irritated, annoyed, and frustrated. Maybe when he's angry, does he use the angry delivery statements that I talk about, that you describe the situation, then you describe your feeling, then you describe the desired outcome. That when they see their father handling anger that way, rather than shouting and throwing things and shaming and blaming, that they're seeing him do it in a positive way, that sticks. And then they pick up on that and they can continue it on because they didn't only hear the steps, they now see them in action. And so for all the lessons, I see that as the key piece is that let's start with making sure we as parents and as adults who are around kids all the time, and I say this in all the parenting workshops I do all over, every adult in the presence of a child is a teacher. You're never not on. You're always teaching.
That is so true. Right. And one only has to read some of the stories in your book, the real, you know, from taken from life stories that you relate to understand that. I mean, the book is so full of things where one says, of course, yes, I absolutely get that. But it is so hard to do in the moment. It's like having to learn a whole new language.
Yes, it is part of what we could call a foreign language, a new parenting language, a new raising responsible boys. There are steps you can take, and you can do them together with your child. I'm learning this as we go. Somebody asked me at a workshop, how would you define parenting? And I'd say, well, it's a series of mistakes, and a parent is going to be a mistake maker all the way. And if you're willing to adjust and learn and grow from your mistakes, then your children will learn and grow with you. So you work to change yourself first, and your child will follow your lead.
They need a lot of help. You know, it always amazes me that the most important job that we undertake in life is the one that we get the least training for.
Yeah, and I get this frequently. There's no parenting handbook out there. And I said, well, maybe not directly. There's a lot of guidance. But here's what I do with parents that come in. I say, well, get yourself a journal book. And you come in with you write down through the week a problem that you've had with your child, how you handled it, what you did, and how they responded to that. And then on the next page, leave it blank, and you'll come in. I'll tell you a different way or a way you could change it or tweak it just a little bit to see if it would be more effective. And we can do that with problem after problem after problem after problem. We just keep coming up with other solutions. And by the time you're done working with me, you'll have your own parenting handbook.
Yeah, well, it would be great if there were weekly lessons that one could attend to remind us, you know, on a continual basis of the different strategies and provide us with lots of tips and tools. But that doesn't happen. You know, we don't have a lot of time. I do want to talk to you about your section on rape culture, what it looks like, what is rape culture, and how we can, you know, teach our children about this and also about boundaries.
Yes, those are two key features that go together with the consent and the boundaries and the rape culture are all like the trifecta of, mm-hmm. of one of the chapters or one of the lessons that we teach. And rape culture is really a term that refers to the social cultural environment in which rape and sexual violence is normalized and somehow it's excused in the media and in pop culture. And it's perpetuated through the use of misogynistic language and the objectification of women and their bodies. And we see it in the glamorization of sexual violence. And it's this culture that the mark of society that creates a prejudice against and sometimes in some ways even like a distrust of women. And it disregards the women's rights and their safety, and it just permeates our society at both that individual level and the one-on-one, and even in the institutionalized structured level, and that we see it there. And I have a list that I just run down of here's what it looks like, so that people can understand. They give 15 or 20 different examples of what it looks like. You know, blaming the victim. Well, she asked for it. Or trivializing, sexual assault. Well, boys will be boys. Speaking about grabbing a woman's private parts and later dismissing it as locker room talk is rape culture. And sexual jokes, laughing at rape jokes or comedy sketches about rape. It's permeating all over the place. You get even comedy shows. If we define manhood as dominant and sexually aggressive and defining women as submissive and sexually passive, that's a rape culture that we're talking about. You know, men are pressured to score, and then we pressure women to not appear cold. Again, there it is, that there's this culture that just is out there to keep women in a particular place subservient to men. Probably the one that's hitting right home for me right now is this assuming that false reporting of sexual assault cases is the norm. It's not the norm. False reporting occurs in 2% to up to maybe 8% in some cases of sexual assault. That's a pretty low number, and so we can't start with that premise that the sexual assault case is a false report. We have to go dig deeper, fully into looking at the situation, because it's such a small percentage. But because people want to say it that way and believe it, that's part of the culture, and that's rape culture.
And it's being propagated even more nowadays. I mean, we're seeing it from the very top all the way down. The recent Kavanaugh, some of President's comments about
yes.
that particular case, the dismissal of the woman's story. Does anyone seriously think that a woman, any woman, is going to put herself out there on, on the public arena, making a charge that isn't true?
Right, and we've come up to this point, and then how Dr. Ford was treated put us many, many, many steps back. Who else is going to want to ever bring something up when they know they're going to be treated like that and made fun of in front of thousands of people? That's just. It's a sad place that we are right now, and that's why we really need to turn turn back and look at our families. How are we raising our sons?
Yes.
And yes, it's how we raise our daughters, but we can't start, you can't make it, well, we better do our daughters first. We better do our sons first so we stop this from continuing to happen.
Yes, absolutely.
It's kind of like saying that women need to have special training so that they know not how to set men off. No, men need to have special training to not be set off.
Yes, yeah. You're absolutely right. And unfortunately, we're out of time, Thomas. I really think your book is a handbook that's so important, not just to parents and sons, but to daughters too. And I highly recommend it. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for continuing to speak out about this. And please keep doing it.
Hey, thank you for giving me the platform to do this with you. It was fun. Thank you.
Thomas Haller, thanks for being with us today. Dissolving Toxic Masculinity, 9 Lessons for Raising Boys to Become Empathetic, Compassionate Men is available from Amazon and also direct from Thomas Haller's website at thomashaller.com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thank you for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.